Making buddies are surrounded by acres of gorgeous bodies in the super musical that's glorified in VistaVision and loaded, simply loaded with color. Yes, the laughs come by the bucketful with the song hits right behind.
What a heyday, this has been my lucky payday and my lucky song. My lucky song.
Shirley MacLaine is that terrific redhead you've been hearing about. The most exciting and delightful star discovery of the year. Everybody says that Shirley's going far in pictures. Jerry thinks she's gone too far already. But when it comes to blondes, Dean's cornered the market with statuesque Anita Ekberg, enticing Ava Gabor, and beautiful Dorothy Malone.
Want you more and more in Amarada.
Say that you're my sweetheart, my love.
And right along with all the music and fun, you'll love this unusual story. For just like Jerry says, this one has a brand new twist to it.
Oh, I gotta get new soles.
We absolutely guarantee you'll be all tied up in knots, too, just from laughing so hard at those ex-Kangaroo Patrol members, Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis.
I'm a tailor who daubs and dabbles with the brushes. To the gals who look so fetching, to the guys who do the sketching, we like to give a hip-hip hooray. We like to tip the over to the artist.
Artists and Models is a 1955 Paramount musical comedy. It is the 14th film collaboration between Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis, the legendary Martin and Lewis. In this film, they play best pals Rick and Eugene, who are two down-on-their-luck types. One's an artist, and the other is an aspiring children's book writer. They get fired from their billboard painting job when Eugene, which is Jerry Lewis, is obsessed with his favorite comic book, The Bat Lady, and he messes the whole job up. They're so poor that that night they just have a single bean for dinner, which Eugene is determined to pretend is a T-bone steak. Eugene has vivid nightmares based on the Bat Lady comics. He imagines a character called Vincent the Vulture, defender of truth and liberty, and also a member of the Audubon Society. Unbeknownst to them, the artist of the Bat Lady comics, Abigail Parker, played by Dorothy Malone, lives right downstairs with her best friend Bessie Sparrowbush, Shirley MacLaine, who is also the model for the Bat Lady. Abigail quits working on Bat Lady after her money-hungry publisher, Mr. Murdoch, demands more and more lurid and violent stories. She ends up becoming an anti-comics activist and uses Eugene as an example of how they can warp people's minds. At the same time, Rick gets a job at Murdoch Publishing doing a Vincent the Vulture comic. Complicating things even further is that Rick has fallen for Abigail and Bessie has fallen for Eugene. Watching all this from afar are a league of spies who have found that the Vincent the Vulture comics feature a top-secret rocket formula that will prove invaluable in the ongoing space race. It all comes to a head at the Artists and Models Ball, where Rick and Eugene have to perform. So, Paul, you recommended that I see this movie when we talked about doing Jerry Lewis, because I know you are the huge Jerry Lewis fan. And I have to say, I really did enjoy this movie. It was a lot of fun. I remember... It was at the video store that I worked at, and I knew that it was about the comic book industry, but for some strange reason, I never got around to watching it, which is amazing considering, but it was really a lot of fun. So when did you first see it?
Boy, I don't even remember when I first saw it. It was made the year I was born, so it was very, which is 1955. So it's likely I saw it on television probably in the mid-60s. I had been already seeing Jerry's movies. I was already a diehard fan. I don't remember the first Jerry Lewis movie I saw, but I was just hooked from the beginning. You know, I must have been like 6-7 years old, and after the Three Stooges, nobody better. And I'm still hooked. I just, to put it in perspective for you, I am sitting on my couch underneath the posters for Cinderfeller, which is a lovely piece by Norman Rockwell. And then there's the Italian poster for It's Only Money. And then the Bellboy poster.
Wow.
And yeah, and then scattered around the room are things like the signed issues of Jerry Lewis comics that I have, and some Neil Adams, Jerry Lewis comic book art, Jerry Lewis books and CDs and comics, and a hand puppet, a Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis hand puppet. It's a two-faced puppet. And then there is a tape dispenser from the 1950s, a Martin and Lewis.
Wow. Tape.
Yeah. So I like Jerry. So, yeah, Artist and Model, you know, when I first saw it, I was already into comic books. So, you know, it just made my head explode. And I probably saw it in black and white the first time, which, as you know from watching it, it's a very colorful movie.
Oh, it's beautiful. Yeah, it's directed by Frank Tashlin, one of the great sort of visual stylists. And we actually covered another one of his movies on the show previously called Susan Slept Here. He always brought a lot of real beautiful visual invention to his movies.
He started out as a Warner Brothers animator.
Right.
And he brought that sensibility certainly to, you know, to this. I mean, there's a lot of shtick in there. You know, the water cooler overheating when Shirley MacLaine is kissing him, you know, the water heater behind him starts bubbling and steaming. You know, just a lot of visual gags like that. You know, the whole opening bit with the giant cigarette face, you know, the smoke. So it's all very cartoony, and then they dump the paint on the guys, you know, real primary color, you know, splashing all over the place.
Yeah, and reds and yellows all of a sudden hitting the sidewalk.
Right, right. So it's just a really, you know, he really did even get a comic book motif going, you know, in that sense. So it's a well-constructed – it's actually the largest budget of any Martin and Lewis film. It was a whole, like, $1.5 million, which in those days
– that was a lot of money.
That was a few dollars, sure.
Yeah, it's shot in the VistaVision. And so, you know, it's one of those big widescreen movies. And, yeah, you mentioned the colors. I mean, at the end of the movie, it has this whole musical sequence where there's an artist palette come to life, and all the gobs of color are women – in different colored dresses. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the thing with the water cooler. Yeah, this is something that Frank Tashlin loved to do. He loved visual gags that really shouldn't work in live action.
Right.
There's that whole scene where Jerry gets a massage, and the masseuse twists his leg up to a point where no leg could go, and then he gets involved with her, and, like, they turn into a human pretzel, and then it becomes this pile of people, like six people deep. And you're just like, how the hell did they do that?
Yeah, and he just, like, slips out of it and leaves everybody else tangled up in a big mess.
Very Bugs Bunny moment.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, and his shoes pop open when Shirley MacLaine kisses him. Like, boy, you know, what's more cartoony than that? So he really brought that, and you know, with Martin and Lewis, the sense of reality was a little bit loose to begin with. You know, they didn't exactly play off of a solid foundation of truth.
Yeah, that's very true.
His stuff was well suited. He made a bunch of movies. This was the first movie he made with Jerry. He also did
He did their final film, Hollywood or Bust.
Right, and then he did a bunch of films with Jerry solo. Including Cinderfeller, which he wrote and directed. And Cinderfeller is one of my favorites. Probably my favorite. Well, it's hard to say. God, it's hard to say, you know? But it's one of my favorite Jerry solo movies. But, yeah, it was good stuff.
Yeah, it's one of the – first of all, I love the idea that this movie takes place right at the sort of apex of comic books at their Seduction of the Innocent period. Right. There's the whole scene where Abigail – there's the TV panel where they talk about how bad comic books are for people. And, of course, they bring out Eugene as the example of sort of the – how low your intellect can sink if you do nothing. The worst case scenario of turning, this is what you'll turn into if you read nothing but comic books. And right. I get the sense that Frank Tashlin is making fun of that. Like he's finding this all to be absurd. Like he's on the side of comic books.
I got that sense too. I mean, Jerry just sits there and babbles. You know, he has this way of just talking in circles, using random words that sound really good, but, you know, like Donald Trump, when you listen to him, he's saying nothing. you know, and that's his, you know, explanation of his psyche. And the people on the panel are sitting there and nodding in agreement with him.
Right, yeah, exactly. So,
I would say you're probably right.
There's a lot of stuff here that is said, again, I think seems like a Frank Tashlin kind of stuff that he was into. I mean, sort of like how Tim Burton, I think, is obsessed with clowns. And
right.
Quentin Tarantino certainly seems obsessed with like...
Well, Tim Burton is actually, I think, more obsessed with ruining everybody's childhood memories.
We all have our things. But, yeah. But like there's this scene where the first time we see Dorothy Malone, where she's coming out of the shower...
Yes.
It is the camera lingers on her body, Hubba. Very much like the wolf in those Tex Avery cartoons.
Hubba. And
it's unbelievable they got away with it in a 1955 movie.
Well, and then she and Shirley MacLaine are lolling around there in their, in their little, you know, micro mini 90s. It was that particular scene. I mean, there's a lot of lingering on those parts, and Shirley MacLaine certainly spends a lot of time kicking her legs up in the air, laying on her back. So
she's adorable in this movie. I hadn't really. I mean, I grew up with her, of course. As she's been playing old ladies for 50 years at this point. She's playing old ladies before she became one herself. But she's not only really adorable in this movie. She's in terms of her physical comedy, really game. I mean, she is a good. A partner to Jerry Lewis. She is just as good at this stuff as he is, and I'm kind of amazed they never did another movie together.
Yeah, it's surprising. I mean, she was a Rat Pack regular.
Right.
You know, she was one of the Rat Pack dames, and she could keep up with Sinatra and those guys. You know, she could handle just about anything. But yeah, I mean, and she made like what, six more pictures with Dean?
Yeah, they went and did a drama together called Some Came Running. Yeah.
Like they were still doing like it was into the 80s.
Cannibal Run. They're in what Cannibal Run 2 together, I think, or something.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, she's terrific and she's really adorable. And I just never appreciated how much Hollywood was trying to angle her as like the next big great physical light comedian, because you just don't think of Shirley MacLaine like that.
Right. Right. No, she's become, you know, a serious actress.
Yeah.
That she could mug with the best of them.
Yeah, she's really cute. And she falls in love with Eugene, which I don't fully understand, because Jerry is sort of in this movie. Jerry is really a bizarre guy. I mean, I guess part of the reason that Rick sticks with him is because Eugene is so positive. I mean, the whole scene where they have literally just a bean to eat for dinner. And Jerry slathers it on with ketchup. Like, he does this whole fake thing of like, no, if you could just pretend. And that's the whole theme of the movie, is pretending. Because they pretend it's a steak. And then there's this scene where they pretend to do a piano duet on a wood board. And they pretend it's a piano. So I guess it's like Rick is sort of, I mean, he's loyal to Eugene, because I think Eugene is sort of helpless without him.
Yeah.
But, you know, I guess he's just sort of charmed by Eugene as this man-child. And you know, he has sort of this, you know, constantly positive outlook on life, even though Rick, you know, and Rick is the one who's a little more down in the mouth.
Yeah. Well, that was the usual dynamic with those guys. Yeah, they were always, Dean was always like, you know, shut up, sit down, eat, you know.
Right.
And Jerry was all over the place. But you reminded me of another Tashlin-esque Warner Brothers cartoon bit that occurs in the movie. One of them is with the steak scene, where, you know, Eugene is telling him, you know, just pretend it's a steak and pretend, and one day you'll get a real steak. And then after Dean goes to bed, there's this argument with the neighbors upstairs.
Right.
And after the argument, the neighbor throws the steak out the window. Jerry catches it, and now he's happy. He's really got steak. And, of course, Rick doesn't believe it's really steak because, you know, his goofy friend. But it was a takeoff on the Honeymooners.
Oh, I didn't know that.
The people arguing upstairs, you know, it was a whole takeoff on the Honeymooners.
Oh, geez. I didn't even think of that. Oh, that's interesting.
And then later on, when the spies are watching, there was that Rear Window riff that they did.
Yeah, they make a reference to Rear Window, which had only been out a year before this movie came out. I love that gag. That is so – and the guy's even doing a Jerry Stewart voice. Jimmy Stewart voice.
Right. But yeah, anyway, that was just – I remembered those bits when you mentioned that the make-believe scene. But yeah, it was and let's not forget Eddie Mayhoff.
Yes, as Mr. Murdoch, the comic book publisher.
I love him. Yeah.
I love the idea. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
But he's in another favorite comic-based movie of mine, which is How to Murder Your Wife.
I've never seen that.
Oh, you're missing a classic.
That's Jack Lemmon, right?
That's Jack Lemmon and Terry Thomas. And what's her name? Verna Lisi.
Okay.
And yeah, he plays a comic strip artist who writes this tough guy comic strip, Bash Brannigan, writes and draws it, and lives in luxury in his midtown townhouse with his manservant. lives a perfect life. Everything is, you know. And then, of course, he gets drunk one night and accidentally marries Verna Lisi, who can't speak a word of English. And now his whole life changes and he becomes this, you know, married schlub. And Bash Brannigan also becomes a married schlub in the strip.
Okay.
And, you know, and now starts losing readership and everything. So it gains readership, but he's unhappy because he's fat and he's, you know, married and so he plots to murder his wife, meaning to murder the wife and Bash Brannigan.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah.
Okay. I'll have to check this out.
And Eddie Mayhoff plays his best friend and attorney.
Okay. He's very funny here as Murdoch. And I love the offices of Murdoch Publishing because they look like the offices from Mad Men. You know, and it's like he has these really nice suits and he's going to these society functions. Like, this is a guy that publishes lurid comic books.
Yes.
And yet he is living the high life in this movie. I mean, he looks like he is super wealthy.
Yes, and they're having meetings at the Stork Club.
Right.
Yeah, I know. There is, you know, I do like the movie, but if you dissect it for, you know, making sense, you're going to hurt yourself.
Yes, that's a waste.
And it's also, you know, just overall, it can be very slow. There are big draggy parts to it, I think, including some of the gags. Like, they linger on the gags too long in a lot of cases. Yeah. I mean, that's my opinion.
Yeah, the movie's like an hour and 45 minutes, which is probably a bit long for something sort of, you know, as light as this. I do say that I liked all the musical stuff. Like, I think that stuff had love. There's this great musical number called The Lucky Song. That's just Dean, where after he gets hired by Murdoch and he's happy. And first of all, it's the only musical number you're ever going to see in a movie where a guy's singing how happy he is that he's working in comics now. Like, that's his big, you know, his life. But that's a great number. It's very singing in the rain.
Jeff John sings that all the time.
Yeah. But it's a terrific song, and it's very open-hearted in that, like, you see kids of all different races in that number, and that's, you know, big budget musicals in the mid 50s were pretty lily white. And so it was kind of nice to see, you know, kids of all colors, and he's got these handing out the comic books, the Bat Lady comics. It's a really terrific number.
Yeah, it is. And the artist and model number at the end is great too.
Yes.
So, you know, no problem there. Yeah.
Yeah.
I just think that, you know, I could have trimmed it, I thought, but
The plot does take a very bizarre right turn when the spies get involved, and it's the whole deal where it's this rocket formula that is just coming out of Eugene's head because he's dreaming all these things, and Rick is basically just writing them down and turning them into plots. But that feels very comic booky to me. That it is. It's just all of a sudden there's spies involved in this story, and there's a spacecraft, and it just feels like it's okay. This is just something out of a comic book, and so it feels appropriate.
Right. Yeah. It comes in very late in the action, you know, in the movie. Yeah. So, like, were you looking to stretch it out at the last minute? I don't know. Yeah.
I mean, it's at that point that the movie jams in all of these other great little actors. Like, that's where Ava Gabor comes in, and Jack Elam comes in, and Anita Ekberg. Like, all these names, you're like, they're all piled in like, the last 45 minutes of this movie.
Right. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe they just, like, you know, it's, hey, they're available. We got to get them in here.
Yeah, we got to get, well, they're under contract. We got something for them to do.
Al Ellis wasn't about to waste a dollar, so.
Yeah, exactly. There's this other great little gag that I love that I have to assume is Frank Tashman's, where we meet Mr. Murdoch's – first we meet what he says is his daughter at the store club, and she never gets a line. She just eats through the whole scene. And then he introduces another woman in a later scene, I think as his niece. And it's the same actress in a different outfit, and she never gets a line. And then we introduce her again as his cousin or something. Right. And it's the same actress once again. And even, I think it's Dean Martin even references it, where he says, you meet her, you meet your whole family or something. Yep. Like, what a surreal gag that it's just, this is the same woman over and over again.
Yeah. Yeah. It's well, Tashman was one of the screenwriters. So, with what, Hal Cantor and Herbert Baker, Baker, I'm not familiar with, but Cantor did, I'm guessing, Baker did as well. But, Cantor did a lot of writing for, Jerry Martin and Lewis. I think he also worked on the TV show and stuff, but I could be wrong.
It's hard to appreciate, I think, for people now how huge Martin and Lewis were.
Oh yeah.
At the time, I mean, I was surprised to know this was their 14th film, and they went on to do one more. I mean, 15 movies—that's an extraordinary run.
Two more. They did 16 total together.
Right. I mean, that is huge, and you know, it's interesting.
In a space of 10 years.
Jeez! Wow.
Yeah.
I've only seen one or two other of their movies, and I didn't fully appreciate how much they kind of overlap each other's turf in the movie. Like at the end of the big final fight scene, it's Jerry Lewis that punches out the bad guy as opposed to Dino, and Dino gets to be funny a lot. I mean, I knew he could be funny because I've seen him in other movies. He was very charming.
Yeah, but that was a bit of an anomaly for especially the later films. The screen time started to turn a bit more towards Jerry because Jerry was, you know, more antic and more, you know, just more entertaining on the, you know, filling the screen doing that stuff. And partly because Dean wasn't involved at all in the making of the movies. You know, he would come in and shoot his stuff and then go off and play golf. And Jerry would stick around and, you know, hover over the editor's shoulder and do this and do that. And so, you know, screen time started going to Jerry. In fact, I think in the next to last movie, it was in Three Ring Circus.
Okay.
Or before that. They took a song away from Dean and Jerry did it.
Hmm.
But this one is very much like a you know, equal screen time for these guys. And there's even a couple of bits where Dean, you know, does some like heavy duty mugging, you know, which you didn't see in most of the other, in those films. 'Cause again, that was Jerry's turf.
Yeah, he's genuinely funny in this movie. And in terms of the creative, you know, how much Lewis got involved, I mean, obviously that's where he was headed because after these two broke up, and they broke up very acrimoniously, you know, Lewis went on to be the director of a lot of his own movie. I mean, he became, you know, an auteur, really.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we have him to thank for, I think it's Video Playback?
Video Assist,
right. We can explain to people who don't know what that is exactly.
That is the system by which a video camera shoots the exact same scene as the film, or in this modern day. Well, I guess they don't need it as much anymore with digital cameras. But anyway, on a film camera, they have a video camera mounted on it as well. It shoots the same scene, and the director can then watch the playback to see if he's got his shot. And it's Jerry Lewis invented it because he was having difficulty directing himself. He couldn't see what he was doing.
Right.
And, you know, he'd have to wait until the stuff got processed and he'd watch the rushes the next day. So he came up with this system. And it is still, you know, it's I think he got a special Oscar for that or some such.
That's amazing. Yeah, I mean, that's just extraordinary. I mean, one last thing I wanted to talk about artists and models before I sort of talk to you a little bit about Jerry Lewis specifically. Do you have any idea who did the art for those Bat Lady covers? They're gorgeous.
No, I don't. I have no clue.
Yeah, I did a bunch of research before recording this, and I really would, because you see a lot of Bat, because it's the only comic book you see. There aren't any DCs or any, you know, right. Atlases or Archies. The newsstand only sells Bat Lady comics. The only right. comics Eugene reading is Bat Lady. And you see a lot of the covers. You see these big, they have posters of them up on the swanky walls of Murdoch Publishing. But boy, they're gorgeous. I mean,
the
paintings are like, I mean, they are suitable for framing. And I can't believe that that's never been uncovered all this time, because they obviously hired somebody pretty talented to do them. I mean, I would have bought that comic if it had existed. It's a gorgeous, it looks fantastic. Yep. Yeah, that's very cool. Now you mentioned earlier Jerry Lewis. Like, I know it's probably hard to explain why you think somebody's funny, because if somebody's funny, they're funny, and you can't
right.
explain it. But do you, like, can you give us at all an inkling of why you think Jerry Lewis is so funny? Why you're such a fan?
He's anarchy, you know, he cuts loose. He has no filter, you know, and for me as a kid, that was very attractive because, I had no filter either. you know, I used to get my head handed to me for it. You know, it just was something about that that was just like, crap, this guy will do anything. He'll say anything. He has no fear. He doesn't realize even, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just so manic and unrestrained. You know, I just, whatever it was, it attracted me and it stuck with me. I mean, you know, I look at this stuff through realistic grown-up eyeballs, and I know that, you know, a lot of it is, you know, I mean, he wasn't making kids' movies. Back in those days, he was making comedies. You know, he was making pretty much. In fact, into the '60s, middle '60s, he started doing, you know, what we would call, you know, adult comedies of the day. You know, sophisticated, you know, farces and sex romps. You know, Boeing and don't raise, you know, don't raise the bridge, lower the water. You know, so, you know. He was he kind of kept up with the times, and then of course you've got the Nutty Professor,
mm-hmm.
which is by anybody's definition, you know, a great comedy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was still working. I mean, by the time I got to be old enough, where my dad took me to movies, he was still cranking out movies. I remember seeing Hardly Working in the theater, and I think I saw one other one. And you know, he was at the end of his sort of film career at that point, but. You know, I grew up with him, of course, as the host of the telethon. I mean, he was, you know, a huge figure in the culture.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And like you said before, Martin and Lewis were huge. They were they were immense. They had a TV show. It was a high-rated TV show. Their movies were, you know, like I say, they made those 16 movies in the space of about 10 years. There was merchandise licensing around them. They're performing. You know, they were the highest paid live performers. They caused riots at the Paramount Theater for their live appearances. There was really, you know, they were kind of the Beatles of their time,
mm-hmm.
and they had an impact on the culture. And Jerry, his impact, you know, he kind of burbled out in the movies at some point, but like you say, he stuck around with the telethon. I mean, he raised something like $2.5 billion over the years for muscular dystrophy.
Yeah, I mean, and he had his own DC comic for what, 20 years? I mean, that comic ran into like the early 70s.
Yeah, it was one of the – it was the longest running of the DC license, you know, real life license characters. I think it's one of the longest running of all time, although I think like Elvira ran longer than him after – at some point. But, you know, because DC had Bob Hope. They had the Honeymooners. They had Jerry. Bob Hope ran a long time too. That ran like 104 issues.
I assume you read the Jerry Lewis comic growing up?
Yeah.
I remember when I first started going to comic shops when I was a kid, and I would, you know, sort of teach myself the history of comics because this was my first access to all the stuff. And, you know, they had back issues of Jerry Lewis, and I was like, that was a thing? You know, like, that was a comic book, Jerry Lewis? I was sort of shocked. And then you saw that like, Neil Adams was working on it. It was like, really? Yeah. Neil Adams was doing the Jerry Lewis comic?
Well, remember, when Neil Adams was doing the Jerry Lewis comic, he wasn't Neil Adams.
Right.
But, yeah, he was, you know, big star, long-lasting. You know, at some point he did become a kid movie figure. Mm-hmm. And, you know, had a big following. His movies were always on TV when I was growing up. And the telethon kept him in the consciousness, although, you know, more as a punchline later on than anything else. Mm. I saw him. He did Damn Yankees on Broadway in the 90s, and I got to see him in that, and went backstage. But before the police threw me out.
I was about to ask, you've met him, right? Because yeah. I think I've seen that picture of the two of you.
I met him that time at backstage at Damn Yankees. A friend of mine knew somebody who was in the cast and arranged for me to go backstage.
How was that? How was that experience?
Oh, that was awesome. My ex-wife, who was with me at the time, said it's the only time she had ever seen me in our, you know, about almost 20 years together. Speechless. So, but I got there. I mean, it was, you know, just a momentary thing. And we shook hands and he signed a couple. I brought a couple of comics that he signed and took a couple of pictures. And, you know, just we actually talked about the comic books a little bit. That was it. But, you know, I got to meet him. I got to shake his hand. So that was very cool.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of times when you get to meet your heroes, it's not always the best thing in the world. So that's great that it was a good experience. And he is one of the last...
With Jerry, you stand the risk of it being a bad experience.
Right, yeah. I mean, he is one of the last surviving people from one of my favorite movies of all time. It's A Mad, 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 Mad World. I mean, he only has a tiny role in that, just a cameo. But that speaks to, you know, his fame that they had to... put him in there because he would have been weird to not have him in that movie because that's one of, you know, it was like every great comedian.
Although that is a movie that somebody someday is going to have to explain why it's funny.
You know, I got to tell you, I took my nephew to it a couple of weeks ago because it was playing on the big screen at the local chain here. And he's 18 and he had no familiarity with any of these people. None. And he laughed. He laughed through a lot of the movie, and I was so pleased that he was just laughing because he thought it was funny, not because he doesn't know who Jack Benny is. He doesn't know who any of these people are.
Yeah. Well, it's like when Jimmy Durante kicks the bucket. I don't get that movie. It's like, you know, can you find anybody less suited for this kind of comedy than Kramer? You know, it's just...
I love that.
I know. A lot of people do. A lot of people swear by it. And it's, you know, but again, I'm the Jerry Lewis fan. And one of my favorite, not for any artistic reason, but for pure sentimental, like, you know, pull my strings kind of stuff is Hook. So, you know, my judgment is not always expected.
We love what we love. There's no.
That's, exactly. Yeah. The hawk wants what the hawk wants.
Exactly. Where do you put Artists and Models in terms of the Martin and Lewis movies? Like, do you think it's one of their better ones, one of their middle ones, one of their not as greatest ones?
I think it's one of the middle ones. I think there are better, and then there are, you know, far worse. That army one they did early on. I'm terrible with titles and names. I've actually got a cheat sheet here with me. It's not a cheat sheet. I've got the Jerry Lewis Films, an analytical filmography of the innovative comic.
Wow.
Published by McFarlane.
Big deal. Okay. All right. Yeah. Well, now you said Cinderfella is your favorite of his solo films?
It's one of the favorites of the. I mean, Nutty Professor, Cinderfella, the Bellboy. Although the Bellboy is just a whole bunch of, you know, shtick. It's you know, put together skits. Mm-hmm. It's still good. And I also like Ladies Man, which is actually that was the movie he created Video Assist for.
Okay.
Yeah. Which it's got a great the set is a two level rooming house, women's rooming house, and you know, it's got this great big open set, you know, so there's a lot of crane shots and stuff. All the tchotchkes that Jerry loves.
Right. I'll have to check that out. I've only seen a couple. I've seen Nutty Professor, of course, but I've only seen a handful of the other Jerry Lewis ones. So.
And he also wrote, by the way, his book on directing. He wrote a little tome on directing several years ago, the Total Filmmaker. Based on a course he taught at UCLA, I think. And it's still a highly regarded book on directing.
Interesting. Oh, wow. I didn't know about any of this stuff. All right. Like I said, I'm going to have to check all this stuff out. I really did like Artists and Models, and so I kind of want to see more of the Martin Lewis movie now because I genuinely did enjoy this.
Good.
Yeah, it's good stuff. So I think this is going to do it for talk about Artists and Models. For anybody who's interested in sort of comic book history, I absolutely recommend that you check this out because it is, you know, a movie made about comics right at the height of their infamy, and that's pretty remarkable. And on top of it, it's just a fun story. It's got some great music in it, and the visuals, courtesy of Frank Tashlin, are really, really spectacular. Plus, you get, you know, some shots of Dorothy Malone looking in a, you know, short towel, which isn't bad, so.
Amen, brother.
So, Paul, thank you so much, man, for talking about the movie on the show. I really appreciate it. Where you always have like 19 projects in various stages of production, but where can people find you on the internet, and what do you have coming up?
Well, I lurk in the dark spaces of the internet and Facebook, you can also find me at paulkupperberg.com, and been doing work with my pal Mort Todd and Roger McKenzie. We've got the new revived Charlton Comics running these days. And in fact, we just published the other day the Donald versus Hillary 2016 commemorative coloring book.
Oh God!
Yeah, it's by me and artist Cliff Mott, and it's filled with 100% of their own quotes, posted on their own petards, they are. That's available. You can find that at morttodd, morttodd.com, or on Amazon. And otherwise, I'm working on a bunch of projects. Hopefully, something will be announceable soon, but, you know. Irons in the fire, and fingers crossed.
All right. As always, Paul's always very, very busy. So for us, of course, you can find the show over on Twitter, which is at Film and Water Pod, and this and all the other shows on the network you can find at fireandwaterpodcast.com. So you can leave your comments there. So, Paul, again, thank you so much for doing the show. I wanted to have you on, and I always like it when somebody recommends something to me that I would not normally see on my own volition, and I really did enjoy it, and so I will have to check out some other Martin and Lewis movie. So thank you so much for doing this.
You're very welcome. And you know, and I think it should be said by one of us before we end this. So it should be me. Hey, lady!
We'll definitely go out on that. So thanks, everybody, for listening. And until next week, that's a wrap.
Scud.
What are you supposed to be?
I'm supposed to be Eugene Fullstack. No, I am Eugene Fullstack. Are you Mr. Murdoch?
All right, come on, speak up, boy. Come on, speak up, speak, 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 speak! Speak, what's on your mind? Spit it out, boy. What is it about?
But you see, I write little stories for children. Children's stories, see? And I
You're a writer. Oh. You have that thin, emaciated, anemic look. Bloodless look. Probably very much in need of a publisher for a great new comic book. Well, why didn't you say so? Come on now, wipe that helpless look off your face. Come right up to me and say, Mr. Murdoch, I've got a great new idea for a new comic book. Are you interested? Come on. Mr. Murdoch, I've got a new great idea for a new comic book. Are you interested? No.